This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, July 22, 2009. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda. Coming up in today's program, Congress struggles to pass a hate crime bill while it stalls on health care reform.
I don't think the public wants to have the insurance companies making every single legislative decision about health care in Washington.
Tribes in the U.S. seek ways to develop green economies in their reservations. And we go to Tokyo, where the conflict between North and South Korea is played out in Japan's Korean community. All these stories and more after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The lawyers of pro-democracy activists Aung San Suu Kyi say they have been denied access to their client just 2 days before closing arguments in her trial are slated to begin. The Myanmar government has accused the Nobel laureate of violating the terms of her house arrest. She faces 5 years in prison. Today, while speaking in Thailand, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton urged the government to free Suu Kyi. She says the gesture could lead to U.S. economic investment in the country. Negotiations have once again been delayed between ousted Honduran President Manuel Zelaya and de facto President Roberto Micheletti, despite increased pressure from the Obama administration on the coup government. FSRN's Nan McCurdy has more.
De facto President Roberto Micheletti says he wants a new proposal from the mediator before moving ahead with talks. Negotiations came to a standstill Sunday in Costa Rica when Micheletti rejected a proposal that would have enabled Zelaya's return. But speaking in Managua, Nicaragua on Tuesday night, Zelaya announced he would return to Honduras within a few days.
Honduran people are going to be respected from now on. For that, we can't lose this battle. I tell my adversaries, you've lost this battle in the face of the world and are losing it in Honduras, and they'll lose it in the next few hours.
The AP reports Zelaya sent a letter to Obama asking the U.S. to use sanctions only against those involved in the coup, instead of broader measures that would hurt the country's poorest citizens. Additionally, tensions between Honduras and Venezuela remain high, as Hugo Chavez continues his call for Zelaya's return. Tuesday, the de facto government gave Venezuela's embassy staff 72 hours to leave Honduras and accused them of meddling in internal affairs. But the Venezuelan diplomats said they would not leave because they do not recognize the authority of the new government. Nan McCurdy, FSRN, Managua.
Oakland, California has become the first city in the U.S. to tax marijuana sales, Africa Jones reports.
Oakland voters overwhelmingly passed a measure that would add a special tax on sales from the city's 4 medical marijuana dispensaries. Right now, the dispensaries pay the same basic tax as other businesses, $120 per $1,000 in sales. That tax will increase to $18 under the new measure. Experts estimate the tax could add nearly $300,000 to the city's cash-strapped coffers. Marijuana advocates celebrated the change as another step toward legalizing the drug for all in the state. California grows nearly $14 billion worth of marijuana a year, and a bill to legalize and tax the drug like alcohol was introduced in the California legislature this year. Oakland's tax will take effect next year. Africa Jones, Free Speech Radio News.
A new report released by Yeshiva University's Immigration Justice Clinic says raids conducted by Immigration and Customs Enforcement are illegal. Christopher Rios with the Community News Production Institute reports from New York.
Today, the Immigration Justice Clinic in New York released the first public study of U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement home raids. The report examines cases in New York and New Jersey and concludes that a majority of ICE home raids are violating Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights. Peter Markowitz, director of the Immigration Justice Clinic, is the co-author of the report.
Over and over again, ICE has been telling the public and telling Congress that its primary goals are to arrest people who pose some threat to national security or some danger to the community. But the data just doesn't bear that out. They've had regrettable mission drift.
Markowitz wants to shift public perception of ICE raids as a necessity to national security and open dialogue for reforming immigration enforcement.
What we very much hope is that this report gives the administration an opportunity to look squarely in the face the abuses that were commonplace under the prior administration, to condemn them and plot a different course.
The authors also cite a pattern of arrests that they say suggests racial profiling of Latino residents. Free Speech Radio News, I'm Christopher Rios with Abulai Ba.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News from Eugene, Oregon. I'm Jess Burns.
In Washington, D.C., the House of Representatives is struggling to move forward with health care reform. Moderate Democrats have halted the progress because of concerns with costs. And as discontent with reform grows, single-payer advocates see progress. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Government-run Medicaid for All, also known as single-payer health care, has been a thorn in the side of Democratic leadership. It has the support of more than 80 rank-and-file members, but Democratic leadership and President Obama ruled it out early on in the health care debate. But despite being shoved under the rug, single-payer advocates received their biggest victory yet. Last week, the Education and Labor Committee approved an opening for single-payer. It paves the way for states to implement a state-run version. Representative Dennis Kucinich authored the measure.
The least that we can get out of this bill is to have people at the various states have the right to have their own single-payer plan, even if we can't get a decent bill out of this Congress.
It would remove a legal barrier put in place 35 years ago that prohibits states from altering the employer-based health system. The measure passed in committee by a vote of 27 to 19. 13 Republicans joined 14 Democrats to support it. Republicans had alternate goals. Mike Castle of Delaware was one of the Republicans in support.
And the Republicans saw this as an opportunity of putting something in the bill that would mess up the Democrats, simply because Republicans were not supportive of that legislation at that point.
The chair of the committee, George Miller, was one of 14 Democrats who voted in opposition. Representative Kucinich concedes that Democratic leadership could strip the measure from the bill at any time.
Keep the state single-payer option in the health care bill. I think public support will keep it in there. I don't think the public wants to have the insurance companies making every single legislative decision about health care in Washington.
Single-payer advocate Charlie Idelson is also a member of the California Nurses Association. He says this big victory is a small concession for single-payer advocates.
There have been all kinds of concessions made to the insurance industry, to the drug companies, to the American Medical Association, to the most conservative Democrats. There's been very little offered to engage the single-payer activists who believe that single-payer is the best way to fix our health care crisis.
But as moderate Democrats have slowed health reform because of concern over the cost, single-payer advocates are seizing the opportunity. Representative Anthony Weiner of New York wrote an op-ed in the news website Politico in which he plans to offer a single-payer proposal to replace the public option. President Obama will give a primetime news conference tonight. He's expected to push health reform and ignore single-payer. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
As the U.S. Senate is trying to complete the passage of a new defense spending bill, lawmakers are grappling over constitutional amendments to the bill. Today, senators narrowly voted against an amendment that would have allowed gun owners to carry concealed weapons across state lines. Another amendment would expand federal hate crimes protections to crimes motivated by gender or sexual prejudice. But the amendment is in jeopardy after Senator Jeff Sessions added a provision on the death penalty. FSRN's Matt Pearson reports.
Republican and Democratic senators are battling over amendments to the Defense Authorization Act. The Matthew Shepard Act is a hate crimes amendment that expands the federal government's ability to prosecute crimes motivated by gender or sexuality bias. Republican Senator Jeff Sessions from Alabama says the Hate Crimes Act infringes on state law enforcement.
States are so much better today. Their police departments are better. Their prosecutors are better. And they are taking on these cases aggressively. And there's just no record to justify a federal intrusion in the state and local law enforcement, the likes of which we probably have never seen.
The ACLU also opposes the act, but for different reasons. Interim director of the ACLU's D.C. legislative office, Michael McLeod Ball, says a phrase in the House version of the bill protects defendants' First Amendment speech and association rights in federal hate crimes cases, but it's missing from the Senate's version. McLeod Ball says the ACLU supports prosecution of gender and sex-based hate crimes federally,
but it shouldn't be based solely or predominantly upon unrelated speech activities to sort of create the impression that it was a hate crime when other evidence doesn't exist.
McLeod Ball supports the amendment otherwise and hopes the language can be ironed out when the House and Senate decide on a final bill.
Now, we didn't take a position that specifically opposed adopting the amendment, because what we hope will happen is that when the defense authorization bill gets into conference, that the House will insist on including its version of that language, and we'll keep our fingers crossed on that.
But the bill has become more controversial. On Monday, Senator Sessions introduced and passed an additional death penalty provision to the hate crimes amendment. It seeks to expand the federal government's ability to apply the death penalty to hate crimes prosecutions. Senator Sessions.
If you make this a federal crime, you could literally have Oklahoma City type case where somebody with hatred in their heart kills 100 people. And it would seem to me that we want to have that option for sure in cases that result in death.
Many civil and human rights groups are opposed to Sessions' amendment. They are urging lawmakers to strike it from the final version of the bill. Again, Michael McLeod Ball from the ACLU.
We believe that there is a pattern of racial disparity in the imposition of the death penalty, both in terms of sentencing and in terms of bringing the prosecution on the death penalty basis in the first place. And we've called for an outright moratorium on the use of the death penalty across the country.
Some 200 amendments have been proposed for this defense authorization bill, which attracts pork due to its reliable yearly passage. McLeod Ball says the ACLU has its eye on other amendments that raise civil rights issues.
We've been concerned about there's some anti-immigration things that could be offered. We're concerned about issues related to reformation of the military commission's proceedings dealing with the Guantanamo detainees.
The Senate hopes to vote on the bill by the end of this week. Matt Pearson, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Default notices, auction sales, and bank repossessions on U.S. homes are increasing this year, according to figures released by RealtyTrack, an online company specializing in foreclosure properties. RealtyTrack says there were nearly 2 million foreclosure filings in the first 6 months of 2009. That's a 9% increase from the previous 6 months. RealtyTrack lists Michigan as the seventh state with the highest foreclosure rates. Its largest city, Detroit, has been hard hit by the foreclosure crisis. The Motor City once boasted the highest rate of home ownership in the U.S., but last year it experienced the highest rate of foreclosures in the country. Some homes in Detroit are currently on sale for prices similar to a used car, with the median sales price at $6,500. But community activists and some government officials are responding to the crisis with new solutions. FSRN's Sacagawea Hall reports.
2.5 years ago, before the housing crisis was front page news, activists in Detroit saw trouble brewing. There was already a high rate of foreclosures in the city, and something needed to be done to keep people in their homes. The Moratorium Now Coalition to Stop Foreclosures and Evictions was created. Sandra Hines joined the group after being evicted from her foreclosed home.
It was such a horrible experience, having them roll a dumpster up to a home that I lived in for over 40 years and take my mother's furniture and toss it into a dumpster just like it was nothing and just like it was trash. And with that experience, just barely escaping and being homeless, I made a decision that I didn't want to see that to happen to any other family.
Hines, along with other members of the group, use various methods ranging from legal actions to know your rights education to what they call street tactics to help keep people in their homes. Brian Pfeiffer is also a member of the coalition.
This has ranged from moving people back into their homes, going into the neighborhoods with sound trucks a few days prior to alert the neighborhood to what's happening to their neighbors and their friends. We've had numerous demonstrations downtown at the Bank of America, which is one of the worst offenders of tossing people out of their homes. And in concert with much of that, we have media campaigns based upon the specific case.
The coalition has also demanded the governor of Michigan declare a state of emergency and enact a moratorium on foreclosures. Although Governor Jennifer Granholm has refused to call a state of emergency, in May, she signed legislation providing a 90-day period for homeowners to work with the housing counselor and negotiate with their lenders for modifications. Senator Clark says the legislation is too little and too late.
It really creates false hope that there's help. This current law merely provides that a lender must send out a letter to the homeowner with a list of housing counselors and legal aid agencies. If the lender does not modify the loan, then the foreclosure case goes to a judge. But the judge doesn't have any power to stop the foreclosure process or even temporarily freeze it. So really, that law will provide very little help.
Senator Clark has introduced a bill that would allow for a moratorium on foreclosures for up to 2 years. Clark and advocates cite the precedent set during the Great Depression when 27 states, including Michigan, enacted legislation to limit or halt foreclosures. Some say Detroit's foreclosure crisis won't be fixed without a strong response from the state government. Lawyer Vanessa Pfluger says, even with local and national legislation, it's difficult to get banks to modify loans.
People try to call their lender. Matter of fact, they get people like me, who is an attorney, to try to call their lender. They don't even call me back one half the time. And when they do, generally it is very difficult to work out any type of reasonable modification with them, if one at all.
Pfluger says the problem is the lack of enforcement measures to support the legislation. She also says the overwhelming numbers of people facing foreclosure is like a gushing wound that needs more than a Band-Aid. One success story that Pfluger and her partner Jerry Goldberg share is the case of Mary Edie. An elderly woman who owned her home in Detroit for 48 years, Edie faced eviction when her home was foreclosed on. With the help of Goldberg and Pfluger litigating on her behalf, she was able to buy back her home from Wells Fargo for $1.
I was so stressed out with it. It did a number on me. Like I said, when he called me and told me about $1, I was just so overjoyed I couldn't believe that.
Jerry Goldberg says in this case and others, they're able to keep people in their homes by putting up a fight. The strategy is often to wear a bank down, but it takes dedicated lawyers, and many people cannot afford lawyers. In addition to subprime loans, rising unemployment and job loss are affecting the rate of foreclosures. Among cities with at least 1 million residents, the Detroit metro area has the highest unemployment rate at 14.9%. The economic recession, coupled with the already declining auto and manufacturing industry, has made a bad situation in Michigan worse. Sacagawea Hall, FSRN, Detroit.
In Arizona, the Navajo Nation Council voted to install a new environmental commission Tuesday. The Navajo Green Economy Commission will oversee the use of state, federal, and private funds for green job initiatives, allowing community members to apply for funds that go towards environmental projects. Native Americans are making several attempts to develop green economies. Tribal leaders from across the country recently met with business leaders and representatives of federal agencies at the Tribal Energy Development Conference in Washington, D.C. FSRN's Melissa Langer reports.
Daryl Francois has been working to facilitate communication between tribal leaders and renewable energy developers. Francois is chief of the Division of Indian Energy Policy Development at the Department of the Interior, and for the past 6 months, he's been using GIS technology to identify tribes capable of supporting commercial-scale wind farms. Using this data, the DOI sent out letters to 70 tribes asking if they would be interested in working with developers. 25 out of the 70 contacted responded positively.
Of those 20 to 25 tribes, we then created a wind atlas, meaning a collection or a book or, you know, however you want to call it, a listing, so that folks could see in a visual sense the data we collected and decide whether or not they are interested in contacting those tribes to see if they're if it's possible to put a deal together.
Some green developers working with tribes are keenly aware of the need to build trust with tribes after decades of both government and oil and gas companies exploiting Native people and land. Roger Freeman is managing director with Citizens Energy Corporation, a third-party developer that works directly with tribes to bring renewable energy infrastructure like wind farms to reservations.
It's critically important when dealing with tribes that one treats them with the dignity and respect that they deserve, and to be very careful about promises that you make so that you live up to them, and to not betray that trust in any way, because you only get one chance. And once trust is broken, very hard, if not impossible, to reestablish with tribal members, in my experience.
In addition to trust, some want more American Indians in state government to help drive policy that represents tribes. Christus Cheney is a member of the Navajo Nation and an Arizona state representative.
The challenge will be able to bring the tribal resources and utilizing the movement that is renewable energies outside the tribes and match them so that there's a fair process between the two. That'll be the challenge, and that's where I say you need to educate and advise, you need to lobby on behalf of your tribal interests.
Though tribal political involvement is increasing, many say equal representation remains critical to the future of successful renewable energy projects. To date, there haven't been any deals made between wind developers and tribes as a direct result of the DOI's Wind Atlas. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Melissa Langer.
Foreign ministers from Southeast Asia, the U.S., and Europe are set to meet in Thailand for the ASEAN Regional Security Forum. North Korea's at the top of the agenda, as Asian governments seek ways to convince the communist country to halt its nuclear program. Koreans currently live in many Asian countries, including Japan, where they make up one of the largest ethnic minorities. Koreans began to settle in Japan in the early 20th century, and although many have never lived in Korea, the community has been affected by the Korean War, the Cold War, and the tensions between North and South Korea. From Tokyo, FSRN's Jason Strother reports on the divisions amongst Japan's Koreans.
Students at this Taekwondo dojo are warming up before practice. Wearing white robes, they go through a series of stretches and poses. Others run before jumping into spinning kicks. Their sensei is former Taekwondo world champion Hwang Soo-il.
Taekwondo is a way of life.
Taekwondo originated on the Korean peninsula, and for Hwang, whose family resettled in Japan several decades ago, it's a means to reconnect with his heritage. The ethnic Korean community here is part of Japan's imperial legacy in East Asia. During its colonial rule of the Korean peninsula from 1910 until its Second World War defeat in 1945, hundreds of thousands of Koreans came to Japan. Some went on their own free will for work or education. Others were conscripted into forced labor. Many returned to their homeland after the war was over, when Korea, now divided into North and South, gained its independence. But much like the peninsula itself, for many of the Koreans who stayed in Japan, their loyalties were split between the U.S.-backed South Korean government and the Soviet-sponsored North. Today, over 500,000 ethnic Koreans, known in Japanese as the Zainichi, hold citizenship of either South Korea or Chosun, Korea's name before Japan's occupation, and what North Korea calls itself now. The latter are represented by the General Association of Korean Residents in Japan, known as the Chosun Soren. Moon Gwang-woo is the group's International Bureau's deputy director.
The Chosun Soren supports the political, foreign, and economic policies of our country, North Korea. South Korea was built by the United States, and thus the government is influenced by the U.S. and Japan. They sold their country to those nations, and now they run it. That's why they do not care as much about our nationality as we do.
The Chosun Soren have received funding from Pyongyang to run Korean language schools throughout Japan. The group acts as North Korea's unofficial embassy in Tokyo, as the two nations do not share diplomatic relations. But most of Japan's 600,000 Zainichi hold South Korean passports, though citizenship does not necessarily indicate political affiliation. These nationals are represented by the group Mindan. Mindan's public relations officer, Bae Cholun, says his organization has tried to maintain good relations with the pro-North Korean Zainichi.
In the past, the two groups did have civil exchanges, but the Chosun Soren turned it into a political issue and reported the meetings to Pyongyang, and the regime halted any future exchanges.
While the political differences between these two groups mirror those north and south of the 38th parallel, their similarities might be greater. They feel Japan needs to account more fully for its early 20th century actions, and both fiercely guard their Korean culture. These are some of the reasons why neither faction wants to relinquish their Korean nationality. and both communities also find themselves the target of discrimination. Mr. Moon of the Chosen Suren. He says the Japanese media does not give an accurate representation of who they are. Moon believes the media follows along with the Japanese government's policies on North Korea and holds them responsible for any problems the two governments have. Japan has a long-running kidnapping dispute with Pyongyang, and many Japanese feared for their safety when the Kim Jong-il regime launched a Pacific Ocean-bound rocket and tested a nuclear device earlier this spring. Yasumori Fukuoka is a sociologist at Saitama University and has studied the Zainichi community. He believes much of the xenophobia the Koreans experience is the result of Japan's education system that praises ethnic homogeneity. This racism, he says, can result in hate crimes.
Ordinary Japanese people blame the Chosen Suren for North Korea's actions. There are extremist groups here in Japan that attack Zainichi school children from the Chosen Suren schools. Female students sometimes get their uniforms slashed with knives. This type of thing happens whenever the media reports on North Korea.
Tensions between the Zainichi and Japanese extremists could soon rise again as North Korea prepares to launch more missiles into the Sea of Japan this month. Jason Strother, FSRN, Tokyo.
And now a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Sonia Sotomayor's stroll to the Supremes. It was a foregone conclusion. When Federal Appeals Court Judge Sonia Sotomayor was nominated to fill the seat of retired U.S. Supreme Court Associate Justice David Souter, the die was cast. While there are few certainties in life, this was an easy call. Relatively young for a judge, well-experienced, a Puerto Rican woman, known as a formidable intellect, the confirmation of Sotomayor was basically a numbers game. Over 50 votes were all but guaranteed for the new president's first high court pick. In Supreme Court confirmation votes, 51 ensures placement. Anything above that is mere surplus. With a Democratic edge in the Senate, this was a done deal. If this is so, why all the Sturm und Drang of rightist senators who try to twist her wide Latina comments like a pretzel? Most of this was stage play, stuff to play on local channels back home to show the good old boys how you made the liberals sweat. But Sotomayor didn't sweat. She sat calmly, patiently, with an even tone, and essentially swatted away pesky objections like flies. She never rose to take the bait dangled before her, for she knew, just as they knew, that she was in. It's a numbers game. Simple as that. And if that weren't enough, Hispanics represent the fastest growing minority in the U.S., and they're immensely proud of Sotomayor's appointment to the court and see it as an historic achievement. It's a done deal. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And that wraps it up for today's newscast. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda.